go so well.
Thank you.
Murphy is or is not?
Good morning and welcome to the January 4th meeting of the Board of Public Works, first meeting for 2012, and I am Anthony Brown, the Lieutenant Governor, presiding over the Board of Public Works in the absence of Governor Martin O'Malley, who extends his best wishes and greetings to each and every one of you and your families as we start a new year and in service to the people of Maryland. And I'd like to turn it over to the Treasurer for any opening remarks that she may have.
Thank you, Governor. Only to wish everybody a healthy and happy new year. It's going to be a tough year, but I think all the signs that look like it's going upwards, which is a very good thing. We're gaining employment, we're gaining revenue, we're gaining in spirit, I believe. And having come off a long weekend babysitting the twins, who are now almost 16 months old, I will tell you it's a great pleasure and relief to be here.
Thank you, Madam Treasurer. Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor Brown and Treasurer Kopp. It's obviously a pleasure to be here at the start of the new year, and I agree. I was happy to get back to work myself. Vacations are not what they're cranked up to be sometimes. But I wanted to just take a moment to recognize the fact that a former colleague of ours passed away recently, Nancy Murphy, a state delegate, state senator, and just a great personality for those who knew Nancy Murphy. She had a very raucous sense of humor. Some would say bawdy sense of humor. But it's a hard business we're in, and the temptation is always there for those of us in elected office to take ourselves too seriously sometimes. And believe me, you could never do that around Nancy Murphy, particularly the birthday card she would send. And she was just a force of nature, and I know that all three of us served with her, I believe we all served with her. I know Treasurer Kopp and I did, and Governor Brown, I think he did also. Great, great personality. But let me wish everyone a happy new year and indicate how.
Peter, I had not heard that Nancy had passed away until you just said this. But I think it's also important to add that she was a person with one of the biggest hearts in Annapolis. Yeah. A great sense of humor, a hard worker, a fun person to be with. I remember sitting up in the balcony in the Senate with, I don't remember why, but with paper bags on our heads, looking down. But also someone who cared a great deal about other people, her colleagues, children, and shocked that I'm very glad that she did something.
Yes, a special person. Thank you. I also just wanted to say that over the holidays, I did have a chance to reflect on the fact that we live in such a tremendous state with so many wonderful people, but also that we live in such a great country. And just happy that I'm able to be involved in the policies of our state and our country, and really appreciate the involvement of everybody out here in the audience. I do think 2012, I hope everything is moving in the right direction, but I believe we're going to realistically face some of the challenges we faced in 2011. And I think it's obviously the year is going to be shaped by remembered by the opportunities we create as we rise to these challenges. But they're real, I mean, we have an extraordinary state. We have great residents. Obviously, we have great leadership. I look forward to working with Governor O'Malley and the legislature and everyone on this in this room, but also in Annapolis as we convene. But, you know, let's be realistic that we want things to move in the right direction, but we've got to be cognizant of the fact that there are some significant issues out there that we have to deal with. So I'm very pleased to be able to work on this board, and I believe that we'll approach things in the same fiscally and socially responsible way that we have, and I'm glad to be a participant in that. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you. I see that we've been joined by Delegate Robinson. Is that you out there? Hi. Welcome. So what we're going to do is we're going to turn now to the, and I see Delegate Murphy's here as well. Happy New Year. And what are you beating your colleagues down here to find the best offices across the street? And or those assignments, I guess, have already been made. Well, welcome to Annapolis. We certainly look forward to working with you closely next week as we embark on a 90-day session of the General Assembly. What we'll do is, it's my understanding that, Delegate Robinson, you would like to speak to, correct me if I'm wrong, to one of the items on the DDM agenda dealing with a custodial services contract let by or at least recommended by MDTA. So why don't we do this as a courtesy that we extend to our elected officials. Let's first turn to the MDOT agenda. We'll take up first item number, I'm sorry, the DBM agenda.
It is MDOT, actually.
Okay, it's not item one on DBM?
No. Different one.
That's a different one. Okay. Who's taking responsibility for that? I will. Okay. MDOT. We'll turn to MDOT, and that's item which one?
Two.
Item two. So why don't we turn to that? And perhaps the best way to start is if we can have a representative, either yourselves, or Madam Secretary, or someone sort of present the item, and then we can hear from Delegate Robinson and anyone else on that item.
Okay. It's item two. It is for janitorial services at DWI Airport, the Maryland Aviation Administration. This is a contract that we're recommending for the via time contract, and I will defer to other people who are more expert from the board staff and others on why, but it's a special type of procurement, and I believe Chimes or these types of providers have a right of first refusal for this type of work, and they have had the work for quite some time. And so it's time to renew the contract, and we're bringing it forward for board approval. And as I said, there are others here who are probably more conversant on sort of the history of these kinds of things. They are considered to be an MBE, although it obviously is in a separate type of category as a service provider than the traditional MBEs.
And this is established under the statutory framework of the MBE program?
It actually precedes the MBE program, I believe. Mm-hmm. And I would defer, I think, to maybe Mary Jo for the legal.
Thank you, sir. There's an absolute priority in statute given to four different sources. Maryland Correctional Enterprises is the first. Blind Industries is the second. Community service providers, which are organizations organized to benefit the interests of mentally and physically disabled individuals, they're the next in line, which is what these two organizations are, community service providers. So this is the third in the line of the four preferences, the fourth preference being individuals with disability-owned businesses. If Maryland Correctional Enterprises or Blind Industries cannot provide the services, then the state looks to community service providers. Maryland Works is actually kind of the state's agent. They work to organize the contracting process, and there's a pricing and selection committee. It also sets the rates for these types of contracts.
But I think the question, if I might, so it is within the MDE.
It is not. There's a separate statutory provision. They're called preference providers. There's an absolute preference for these types of contracts before an agency can go out on the open market to procure a service.
Okay. So.
Okay. I mean, so yeah.
We go to these providers first as required. We don't do a typical bid procurement where we're soliciting.
And then so you were required by law
yes.
to
yes.
go first to these yes. providers. Thank you.
Okay, do we need to hear anything more? If I could just ask, I take it the contracts are limited to certain areas, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe, well, again,
that's
I
mean, preferences.
I mean,
what is the,
they're for social, I think social services type, but this is one of them.
The pricing and selection committee actually designs a list of supplies and services that can be provided from these preference providers. So there actually is a finite amount of opportunities under this preference.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, then why don't we ask, invite Doug Robinson to present, and then certainly there may be more questions, there may be rebuttals from the department or something like to that extent. Good morning.
Good morning, and I thank you for the opportunity to present. I have several questions because, as you know, I have House Bill 29 in that would preclude nonprofits from being counted as MBE, WBEs. There's a difference between minority businesses and nonprofits. Nonprofits are able to bid on contracts and not have to have any administrative fees. I mean, in some instances, their businesses or their locations are donated because it's a tax write-off. In some instances, they don't have to pay for staff because it's a tax write-off. So for a minority to be classified as a minority, they have to be 51% owned and operated by a minority individual or from a certain group of African-Americans, women's, Hispanics, et cetera. They also have to have a certain amount of money. It was $1.5 million and just went up to $750,000, so now that's $2.2 million, I think it is. But those things are not required of a nonprofit. And when you say that this bill, that we, I mean, this contract that we're talking about now is minuscule, $63 million, I don't call that many at all. And I'm not here to be confrontational, because I've been in business for almost 30 years in Maryland, so I am a minority business. I'm also the co-founder of the Greater Baltimore Black Chamber of Commerce, and I sit on the board. Plus, I sit on the board of 20 other nonprofit organizations in Maryland. So I'm not against nonprofits. What I am saying is that there should be a even playing field. Because when you put MBEs up against nonprofits, there's not a even playing field. Because a minority business with a operating budget of $750,000 or $1 million cannot compete against a minority, I mean against a for-profit that has a $40 million budget or a $50 million budget. And for this bill, for this bid to be specifically to Chimes, I would like to know why there are not any minority businesses subcontracting with this contract. The 25% minority participation does not seem to apply to this contract. And I would like to know why, number one. And you talk about other procurement opportunities with the Department of Corrections and others that you just mentioned. I'd also like to know the contracts that they get, what are the percentage of minority participation in those contracts, if any? And if there are not any minority participation, I'd like to know why. And I'd also like to know why this type of contract, you're talking about janitorial services. There are many, right off the bat, I can come up with at least four now. But there are many minority businesses in Maryland that can perform janitorial services. So whatever name you put it under, to me, it's a sole source. It may be called by a different name, but it is a sole source. And I'd like to know why. So if you can get that information to me, I'd be appreciative.
Okay, why don't we do this then? If you could respond to Delga Robinson in writing on that, and if you need clarification on the questions, you can certainly work offline on that. And certainly copying the Board of Public Works would be appropriate since the questions were raised here. So we'll make sure that you get the answers to those questions. Let me do this.
I will ask you another question. Is there a possibility that this contract cannot be issued or be reissued after it's been looked at to see why there's no minority participation in this contract?
Well, let me,
we're talking about $63 million.
Let me propose this. Anything's possible. We certainly could delay it if that's the will of the board. I'm not sure if that's the direction that we're going in. Let me do this, though, as sort of, again, another a courtesy to you, since we typically don't have people who are presenting to us asking the questions. But as a courtesy, let me sort of take the gist of your questions, and I'm going to rephrase it for a response kind of on the record here today, so maybe we have a better understanding here as members of the board. When you look at the you're not calling them the nonprofits, and again, what's the term that they're
preference providers?
Okay.
Is a generic
as
term.
You when you look at the preference providers within that look, is there an NBE requirement?
There is no prohibition that I know of against putting an NBE goal on a preference procurement, except for blind industries. There is a restriction on blind industry procurements. As to why there was not an MBE goal put on this particular procurement, I can't answer. Maybe the agency would be able to better answer why there was no goal on this particular procurement.
So, Linda, I just want to kind of make sure I understand clearly your response to my question. As you're looking at the, help me again, priority?
The preference providers.
Preference providers. And first of all, is there a finite list of preference providers that you look at? Or someone like in the MBE program, does a preference provider need to be certified as a preference provider?
Well, typically they have expertise in different areas, and the agency goes first to Maryland Works, who kind of works with them to find out who the most appropriate organization would be to do the type of work that they're looking for.
But do you know whether or not Maryland Works is looking at a list of providers that are sort of certified or identified or designated in a way similar to the MBE program?
There is Bob Hoffman, from the executive director from Maryland Works, is here, and he might be more
come on up, Bob.
Appropriate for responding to some of these questions.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Good morning. For the record, Bob Hoffman, President and CEO with Maryland Works. There are about 30 preference providers under this portion of the preference procurement, and they do go through a certification process with the Division of Rehabilitation Services. We need to distinguish that in this case we're talking about preference procurement. There are three preferred providers, as Mary Jo has specified: the prison system, job training program, blind industries, and then it's actually the Employment Works program. And it's a very limited set of providers that qualify under this. Separate and away from that is the MBE program. The total procurements in the Employment Works program, including the one that you're considering today, total about $36 million, less than 3% of the total state MBE purchases. At the same time, there is a general nonprofit eligibility within the MBE program, where there are several hundred million dollars in contracts that are currently included or counted toward meeting the MBE requirements. And I believe Delegate Robinson's bill addresses that specific issue within the MBE program. And we're aware now that the bill is in, and we're looking forward to getting together with her and helping to sort out some of the policy issues related to that particular issue. But again, that's the MBE program on the whole. In this case, we're talking about a contract that falls under preference procurement, a relatively small program. This just happens to be the largest contract under our program, but again, the cumulative total is about $36 million a year, a very small portion of the state's MBE outcomes.
The MBE total is how much?
The MBE total is $1.3 billion.
$1.3 billion.
And this is $36 million. And again, if you look at within the MBE program, nonprofits that specifically are utilizing these contracts for training and employment of people with disabilities to address employment discrimination, historical employment discrimination of people with disabilities, we're talking about, again, less than 3% of the total MBE program. Now, it just so happens that under the statute, the state purchasers could not count the prison system training program's outcomes toward the MBE, but they can count the VISM and the Employment Works Program outcomes toward the MBE requirements. In this case, this contract before you meets a very high standard of outcomes related to addressing employment of discrimination against people with disabilities, in that over 75% of the jobs under this contract are utilized for training and employment of people with disabilities. That, again, is separate and away from the purchase of social service contracts from nonprofits within the MBE program. That's a much broader dollar amount, and again, those issues will be taken up by the legislature in the coming weeks.
That clarifies a lot for me. Any other questions or comments from members of the board?
Thank you.
Great. Did you have anything else, Delegate Robinson, that you wanted to present, or that pretty much presented your issue? Okay.
I thank you very much for the opportunity, but I would get the other individuals to work with.
Thank you.
Only though.
Do you want to come back up if you can, please?
I would like the board to consider reissuing or holding this. I mean, you keep saying that 36 million or 63, it's a small portion, et cetera. But when you get into millions, that's not a small portion for a minority business. I mean, $1 million, it's not a small portion for a minority business. So I would just respectfully ask the board if they would either reissue or reconsider adding minority participation in this contract. We're talking about $63 million. I thank you.
Thank you. Okay, anything further from members of the board? Okay, why don't we take up this issue with the remainder of the MDOT agenda. So any other questions or comments on the MDOT agenda? We're on MDOT, right? Yeah. any other questions, comments on the MDOT agenda in addition or other than item number 2? Okay, Comptroller.
That was a question.
Well,
just to go back to that.
Item 2.
That item 2 for a moment. I want to hear that under this contract, in fact, they are going to be using green practices and equipment.
I believe the short answer is yes, but Wayne could give you
a question.
Wayne
can also know. Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Wayne Pinnell, Deputy Executive Director, Operations Maintenance. Yes. We also
thank
work
you.
With BISM to ensure that we're using green products.
Well, I know actually the BISM has been interested in this for some time, Mr. Hoffman for some time, both in the practices and training people because you have to use them somewhat differently, what to look out for, how to use them, but also the tools and the fluids and everything else.
The majority, what we've truly done is the majority of the work performed on the terrazzo and the tile floors,
right.
We've gone away from the use of chemicals. And we've gone to a honing, which is a very specified and it's a technique that we use to shine the floors itself without using chemicals. So that portion becomes green. In addition to that, we work with BISM to purchase where chemicals needed in restrooms, for instance,
right.
Glass cleaning. We're using products that are considered.
So our employees, our folks, our contractees are not breathing in evil chemicals.
That's correct.
Or leaving them for the rest of us. That's very good.
There's a high focus on going green wherever possible.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yes.
Any other questions, comments, issues? Item number 2 or any other?
Well, I just want to thank Delegate Robinson for coming up and giving us her views. I think from what I'm hearing, this is a situation that actually predates even the MBE legislation, these preferences. So I think the best way to sort this out is in the legislative process. I'm not sure what your legislation is exactly says, but I certainly appreciate you attending and presenting your views. And I'm going to vote to approve the contract. I just wanted to make sure you knew that I think that the right forum probably is around your legislation in the session. Please keep us informed how that proceeds, because...
Thank you. Right. So moved by the comptroller, seconded by the treasurer. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none. MDOT's agenda in its entirety is approved. Let's go to thank you, Adele.
And we and the staff here will be following the legislation. Let us know what it is. I think that we are doing what the law requires right now, what the law expects right now, and if the laws change.
Thank you very much. Let's turn now to the Secretary's agenda, and I'd like to, if we could, take up item 5 first on the Secretary's agenda. It's a wetlands license for work performed in Talbot County, and I understand that there are several people to speak on or to that item, so perhaps we can start by asking... for a presentation briefly of the item.
Sure. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, and Comptroller. For the record, I'm Dolden Moore, Wetlands Administrator, and the case before you today is Wetlands Case 100935. Julia Monaco is the applicant. She has requested a license to construct the living shoreline and other structures at her property on the Chesapeake Bay on Tillman Island in Talbot County. The elements of the project are to construct a 130-foot-long pier with a boat lift, a single osprey pole, and the major part of the project is to fill, grade, and plant marsh vegetation along 590 feet of eroding shoreline and 3,360 cubic yards of sand and low-profile stone sand containment sill in place within a maximum of 68 feet channel to the mean high waterline. Living shorelines are the preferred method of protecting one's shoreline. They are natural and provide both low and high marsh habitat. Environmental Article 16201C states improvements to protect a person's property against erosion shall consist of non-structural shoreline stabilization measures that preserve the natural environment, such as marsh creations or living shorelines. We have present today environmental concerns as Ms. Monaco's agent with a presentation to the board. We also have persons wishing to speak in opposition to the project, and I have staff from MDE and DNR present to answer any questions that the board may have. And with that...
Okay, well, thank you very much. Why don't we, if we could, why don't we start with the interested persons in opposition to get a sense of that, and then we can hear from the applicant and or the applicant's representative. I think that should work. So why don't we thank you very much. Please don't go off anywhere. Why don't we start with, unless you have you want to do it differently, we've got Jill Johnson, Tillman Island Beach Association, followed by Deanne Scher, Tillman Island property owner. Does that work? Oh, that's why you stood up. You're Dean? Yeah, okay. See, the reason why I did that, just so that you know, my 11-year-old son, Jonathan, in grammar, I'm teaching him that the vowel that precedes the last consonant, if it's followed by an E, then it's a strong vowel. So that's why. Now, how is your name spelled?
It's a very nice comeback.
How's it spelled?
D-E-A-N-E.
Okay.
Dean, the usual spelling of Dean, just a little different, so we add another E on the end.
Okay. How are you doing?
I'm able to sit up and take some nourishment. Thank you.
Is Jill here?
Yes.
It's not Jilly? Okay.
Lieutenant Governor Brown and distinguished members of the board, over hundreds of years, God created the biggest and most beautiful beach on Tillman Island, and I think that's undisputed. In one season, Ms. Monaco, an environmental concern, I call them environmental unconcern or environmental lack of concern, totally destroyed the beach. And they continue to do whatever they want to do, even though there was a cease and desist order in this case while the matter is under advisement. Fairly recently, we just took these pictures last weekend, and I apologize. And the information I received, I didn't realize I was supposed to have five sets of these. So if you would permit me after the hearing, I could submit the additional four sets. These photographs show that we just took these last weekend, show the stakes that they've been putting out in the water. Notwithstanding, they're not supposed to take any action at this time. Also, while this matter was under advisement with Megan Senkel, a natural resources planner, and no action was to be taken, they used the bobcat to move the sand from the beach further up on the Monaco property. So I now want to submit those photographs that shows the bobcat, shows the tracks of the bobcat. Thank you very much. And I would submit to you, and the Department of Environment did nothing about this, although there was a cease and desist order, and they weren't supposed to take any action until this matter was decided. It was under advisement with Ms. Senkel for approximately a year, and then, of course, it's still under advisement pending this hearing. Over 60 years, the residents of Tillman Beach have walked this beach, and I've walked it for the last 13 years. Environmental concern told the Department of the Environment there's been a tremendous erosion problem. I submit that is deceitful. Pure and simple, there wasn't an erosion problem until they removed the Phragmites. The pictures that I'm going to submit also show that there is a very large beach, and it's just been moved from close to the water further up on the Monaco property as a result of the bobcat. We do not believe that the Department of Environment did any of their own testing of the alleged erosion problem. In other words, they just accepted, they accepted the statistics of environmental unconcern. And this absolutely has ruined the beach belonging to the Tillman Island Homeowners Association. And I have some photographs I have to keep you this busy. This first photograph shows the size of the beach above the Phragmites. These next two photographs show the beach to the south of the property in question, which is comparable to what it was before environmental unconcern came on the scene. Now, we met with Ms. Monaco and a representative of environmental concern, and we were told they wouldn't do anything to bother our beach. Our beach has been destroyed. The mission of the Department of the Environment states to protect and restore the quality of Maryland waters and land resources. And we feel the Department of the Environment has ignored the fact that this beach is home to turtles, horseshoe crabs, many other species. The largest concentration of horseshoe crabs in the world is in the Chesapeake Bay region. Disturbances in this case adversely affect the spawning activities, and the modifications attempted by Ms. Monaco prevent horseshoe crabs from reaching traditional spawning areas. The Department of Environment, we submit, ignores the fact that the Department of Natural Resources is asking for help in identifying shoreline used as horseshoe crab spawning habitat around the state of Maryland. Additionally, I would submit Pawpaw Cove, which includes the waters fronting the Monaco property, has been declared an oyster sanctuary. The Department of the Environment's comment in the wetlands report and recommendation that approximately 81,940 square feet of existing vegetated wetlands will be enhanced is off the mark. For reasons no one can understand, the Department of the Environment has ignored what the Department of Natural Resources said, where the Department of Natural Resources cited the properties having a low erosion rate, strong sand accretion, as well as being potential habitat for horseshoe crabs and diamondback terrapins, which we also have in this area. So we feel they ignored what the Department of Natural Resources said. And again, we feel they blindly accepted unsupported statistics of environmental concern because, again, the alleged erosion only occurred as a result of removing the Phragmites. environmental concern also stated that the beach elevations are below what's required to support terrapin or horseshoe crab nests, and that the strip of beach is not sufficiently wide for the nesting purposes of these species. Well, the photographs that I've submitted and will continue to submit will tell you that this is certainly suitable for horseshoe crabs, and myself, as well as members of our association, have seen countless horseshoe crabs over the years on this beach. Now, most of the properties in our community do not have water access. Taking away our beach obviously decreases our property values. And I can't emphasize enough, a living shoreline does not last on the Chesapeake Bay. The living shoreline is not really suited for the Chesapeake Bay, and as a result, most contractors will not do that work because they consider it unethical. I do want to submit at this time, these are pictures. The first picture will indicate what our beach, the Homeowners Association beach, looked like prior to environmental concern coming on the scene. And the next two photographs show what's happened to our beach as a result of what they've done. So in closing, we feel that what's happened here is with the relationship of an environmental concern with the Department of Environment, because they have a relationship, and we feel that that is what has been relied on rather than the facts that have resulted in this recommendation. Thank you very much.
Any questions at this point? Please don't go anywhere. There may be some questions that arise. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Jill, we invite you to speak. Good morning.
Good morning. Okay, my name is Jill Johnson, no E's. And I represent the Tillman Island Beach Association, so I'm speaking a lot of what Dean said. I'll try not to repeat what he said. But I'd like to thank the board for giving me this time to present our objections to the installation of a living shoreline next to our community property and part of the shoreline of Pawpaw Cove. So why do we object to the project? It's partly because we feel that a healthy, stable beach is healthier for the bay than a created marsh. And a lot of our neighbors are watermen, and they depend on a healthy bay for their livelihood. And beaches are very rare, as you know, in Talbot County, and this is one of the few remaining beaches. There's only one other beach on Tillman Island. And additionally, as Dean said, recreationally, we have always been able to step down from our community property onto our little beach and to be able to use the water. And if this project goes through as currently designed, it will make it very difficult, if not impossible, to make that transition from our community property and onto the bay with our kayaks or whatever. So those are objections. Now I'm going to quickly go through the three topics. Erosion, I won't repeat what Dean said. Issues between Maryland Department of the Environment and Department of Natural Resources, and a possible critical area violation committed by the contractor, environmental concern. I don't think there's any ill intentions. I don't think there are any evil people involved with this whole issue. I think there may be some incorrect information and some lacking information. But I think everybody has good intentions. But I think, we just want to clear up some of the issues that have been going on. Now, first, the erosion. The main thing with the erosion is that Environmental Concern did a study recommended a living shoreline to the homeowner. Department of Natural Resources came down, looked at the property, and in January of 2011, I don't know if you have copies of these memos, Greg Golden, I think is here. Yeah. Hello. Sent a memo to Rick Ayala of Tidal Wetlands Division of MDE, and in part stated, based on the site visits by personnel from the Department of Natural Resources and historical erosion rate maps, there seems to be a significant buildup of material on portions of the beach. Photographs from previous years seem to indicate that this is an accreting beach and is not just a seasonal phenomenon. In light of these facts, a living shoreline project of this magnitude appears excessive. And they also talked about Merlin. the Merlin maps and the historic shoreline maps. I think you have some of those in your packet. And he concluded by saying that the applicant should explore other means of providing shoreline protection if the Maryland Department of the Environment deems that protection is warranted for this site and that would preserve the form and function of the sandy beach habitat. And we won't go into dueling photos, but I know you have a significant number of photos of the beach. Now, we also had, in May, I don't know if you had this copy, Environmental Concern did do some studies, and they concluded that there was anywhere from 4.8 to 28 feet of erosion along the shoreline, with a major part of the erosion taking place at the northern end of the property. Now, the northern end of the property, I think Dean's given you a copy already of some pictures, and we'll send in more copies if needed. The northern end of the property, most of that structure is actually our beachfront property, if you could call it beachfront property, you know, our common area. It's not part of the Monaco property. It abuts the Monaco property, but is not part of it. And I, in case they're a little different from what Dean gave you, I'll this shows. Now, I think there is some erosion there. It's possible that we've lost, in the last 2 years, maybe 4 feet of property. Part of that's a lot of rain that's been coming down. We've had a hurricane. I don't think the earthquake had anything to do with it. But has been significant erosion there. And we haven't been too worried about it because we have a lot of property before it gets to any homes. Now, so after the May report, the Department of Natural Resources, again, stated their objections to the project. There's a June 15th letter from Maryland Department of Natural Resources to U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, where they stated, in part, the shoreline to the north and south of Pawpaw Cove have experienced significant erosion over the past 150 years, but the shoreline in Pawpaw Cove, of which this is part, has experienced much less erosion, seemingly very little over the past 50 years. The area of Pawpaw Cove that does appear to be suffering from erosion is located at the northern end of the project area, a large part of which is, again, our property. The erosion in this area is most likely due to the installation of revetment along the shoreline that abuts the Monaco property, which was put in, 20, 30 years ago, long before I was there, so I don't know anything about it. While the erosion of this portion of the Monaco property may be real, there are techniques that can be employed that would be much less intrusive and much less expensive, by the way, for the property owner, and would significantly reduce the erosion in the northern part of the project. In summary, the existing habitat assemblage along the shoreline of the Monaco property, Pawpaw Cove, is an excellent example of intact, complex, and highly functioning beach habitat. So that was June 16th. There was another report from Environmental Concern in July, again, stating what they felt was more relevant to the project. Now, one other thing I want to mention about the Tidal Wetlands Report. On page 2, on the third paragraph, there's a statement that says, to further support this data, it was noted by Maryland Department of the Environment, the majority of the shorelines on Tillman Island Beach are hardened, removing the source of sand which nourishes the remaining beaches. Now, we also, I think Dean sent these pictures as well. There are pictures of, there's two lots. There's a lot that is hardened, and then there's another lot that is not, that's owned by the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy. They bought this property to preserve it, and specifically because it was a stable, nice, sandy beach. And there's Indian activity going back 13,000 years on this property, and they wanted to preserve it. And that's what these pictures show. The pictures show the nice sandy beach there is taken November 17th of last year. And this is a picture of the hardened property that's in between the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy lot and the Monaco lot. It's hardened, and even here, there is sand buildup. There is sand accretion in front of the sill, which is very unusual. But this shows you the unusual topography of Pawpaw Cove. And sorry we didn't bring 5 copies, but we were unaware that we needed 5 copies. Okay, so now about Pawpaw Cove. Bay Journal, back in December of 2009, when the Eastern Shore Land Conservancy purchased the property, published an article, and it's available online. Again, there may be copies in there of what you have. What they said about Pawpaw Cove was that Pawpaw Cove is a unique site. It's one of the scarce bayfront locations and the only one in Talbot County with a natural, stable, sandy beach. Shoreline maps show it has suffered little of the erosion endured by most of the rest of Tillman Island since the 1800s. So even though a lot of Tillman Island is hardened, and there's been a lot of erosion. There's something very unique about this area. Okay. Page two. Now, the wetlands report was issued by MDE on November 2nd, and after this, Mr. Golden sent an email to Rick Aiella of Department of and the Environment, and in part stating, there's a statement in the Tidal Wetlands report down at the end of paragraph 3 on page 2 that states, Maryland Department of the Environment and Department of Natural Resources have since resolved the issue and agreed to move forward with the project as designed in the most recent set of plans. Well, this is what Mr. Golden, and he knows I'm reading this, said in his email. A primary concern of ours upon reading the wetlands report in view of our programmatic concerns is the wording chosen in the report, and I just read the statement. We do not want the status of this individual project to be viewed as a precedent or indication of resolved programmatic habitat concerns. It's very important to emphasize at this point in our review team does not have programmatic concerns and issues on the overall living shoreline topic. That our team does have programmatic concerns and issues on the overall living shoreline topic that have not been resolved. They were not resolved at the July 26 meeting and were deferred by cancellation of the Monaco site visit. There was another planned site visit, but it was put on the kibosh by Hurricane Irene that we probably all remember. For this specific wetland report, which we understand has already been sent to the board, our review team did not see the referenced resolution status as accurate. So obviously there are some problems. I don't think they're evil intent problems between DNR and Maryland Department of the Environment, but they really haven't had a chance to sit down and resolve the differences. I mean, DNR feels there's no erosion, and there are other people stating they feel there is erosion that indicates that a living shoreline should be installed. Now, going away from erosion for a minute, I'd like to address a possible critical area violation which occurred on the property on June 29th of 2011.
Before you do that,
mm-hmm.
Okay, is that the bobcat we saw on the in the pictures?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm just going to ask. We heard about it. It's been raised, but I'm going to ask you to hold off on that for now. And the reason why, if any of the other members want to hear more, I'll certainly defer to them. But the question before us is whether or not a wetland permit ought to be issued, and you presented certainly a very comprehensive position on that. The issue before us isn't whether or not there's been a violation.
Okay. I can skip that.
Yeah, and that you brought it to our attention, and if the other board members want to hear from it, I'll certainly defer to them. But at this point, let me just ask you to sort of, you know, defer on that. Let's hear from the applicant's representative so we can kind of get, you know, sort of a little back and forth here, understand their views, and then we may very well ask you to come back up.
Okay.
Is that
yes,
fair
I
enough?
Do have a quick finish, but I'll hold that.
Okay, great.
Until after Mr. Schlesinger.
Thank you.
Okay.
Wow. Good morning, Madam Chair, Mr. Comptroller. Governor Brown. My name is Gene Slear. I'm with Environmental Concern, a public not-for-profit company in St. Michael's, Maryland. I have a visual presentation for you that addressed most, if not all, of the issues that have been placed before you to date.
Let me just stop you before you get started. We have in here, I don't know, maybe 50 photographs and other representations. You're not going to take us through all those, are you?
I'm going to flip through them.
Just flip.
No problem.
Okay. Hit the highlights.
This is our photograph of the Monaco property from the south looking north when we first became involved in November 2008. Oops. A little bit about Environmental Concern. Dr. Garbush, our founder, developed the protocol for living shorelines, embraced later by the state of Maryland. We've had two presidents in our entire history. Dr. Garbush retired in 2005. Suzanne Pittenger-Slear is our president since that time. We've been at it for a good while. Picture in 72, same activities in 2005. The only difference is the color. We have three major functions. We grow in our nursery in St. Michael's. We're teaching all the wetland sciences to professionals all the way down to school children. And we restore and create tidal wetlands. Over 30 miles of shoreline have been created in the Chesapeake Bay watershed, and almost 1,000 acres of marsh have been restored since 1972. We are a company that is science-based, fact-driven practitioners, and who still get wet and muddy every day in our practice. A property that was before this board several years ago is the Ruesch property in Follies Quarters. You may recall that, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Controversial issue at that time, 1,300 lineal feet of living shoreline to replace a failing bulkhead. It's an involved project, but you'd like to see the finished product. There's now a vibrant marsh in place. A little background, maybe a little more comprehensive than what was presented before. This is Pawpaw Cove. The popular name for this is a cove on the main stem of the Chesapeake Bay. There is a 21-mile fetch to the north, 12 miles to the west. It is just outside the Chop Tank watershed. The boundary for that, the fall line, is the road. Tillman Beach, shown here, is to the north of the property, as well as the remainder of Pawpaw Cove to the south. Again, this is what we were presented with. At mean high water in the winter of 2008, there is no beach evident. It is covered with phragmites, an invasive and toxic species that we have worked hard to eliminate over a three-year period. We cut it in 2009, treated it. This is a low tide. The root mat is being gradually covered by sand that's being pushed back. This is at the October 2010 meeting of the regulators on the shoreline. Here, Maryland Department of Environment by Megan Senkel, DNR, and the Critical Area Commission by Nick Kelly. The Army Corps of Engineers is there, and so is the Talbot County Planner. We reviewed the application as it stood at that time. We received recommendations and comments from the regulatory agency after a site visit, and we incorporated them in our final application, which was accepted by the Maryland Department of Environment in late October. It was then presented at a public hearing in December of 2010, which the Tillman Beach Association was represented. Ms. Johnson was there, as were the regulatory bodies, regulatory representatives. I do not believe DNR attended that meeting. This is an overview of the properties that were referred to in the photographs. I'd like to give you some perspective on this, if I could. This is the Monaco property. The red line is the outline of the 72 wetland as defined in the regulations. It extends, it's an occluded tidal inlet that extends back up into the Monaco property. The yellow line is the mean high water line as of 2009. The dotted yellow line is the 100-foot critical area buffer required by law.
What's the red line again?
The red line is an overlay delineating the 72 wetland maps. Okay. I'll show
that's
that.
What it looked like in 72.
Yes.
Got it.
I'll give you a better picture of that in a minute. Here we've zoomed in on the Tillman Beach Association private properties and public lands right here. There's the Monaco property. Again, mean high water 2009. Notice the critical area, 100-foot critical area buffer over here. This is the 100-foot critical area, mean high water buffer. Here's the edge of tidal wetlands. This Monaco proposes to build 330-some feet off of mean high water and a goodly distance off of the edge of tidal wetlands. You see this is a proposed house location. More information on the 72 wetland maps. What happened, I'm going to go to a graphic right after this. This was upland or high marsh in 72. Extended right along here and then joined the bulkhead or the armor property to the north. This is an occluded tidal inlet. There was, at one time, reasonable tidal flushing occurring in this area. This graphic depicts that. Again, here's the 72 tidal wetland map showing the tidal inlet. Here's Ms. Monaco's property line. Here's the property line on the south. Here's what's happened over time. This is upland in this presentation. As this land eroded since 72 and moved back, at the same time, it was moving and depositing this in the tidal inlet, raising the elevation of that, which supported Phragmites, that noxious invasive weed. That has now overtaken the entire inlet. It is fully occluded now. And as you can see, the shoreline has moved back, and this entire peninsula is now gone. With our erosion, Phragmites elimination, we have first cut, then treated the Phragmites, cut it and treated it again on the property, and we have now achieved success, we believe, and we are prepared to move forward with the wetland license, have been prepared to move forward for a goodly period of time. What we are proposing is to restore tidal and non-tidal wetlands in this area, construct a stone sill which will serve to contain the new marsh placed in the footprint of where upland used to be. Now watch what happens when that's constructed. We have enough sufficient openings so that the daily flushing of the tide, twice daily flushing of the tide, will allow for that intertidal zone to be completely washed. The water quality benefits of that are significant, and we improve the habitat by constructing that with those tidal inlets. Much has been said about erosion. This is our picture in March of 2011 of the tidal effect on that shoreline. This is a low tide, storm, wind-driven. Oops. Another graphic representation. This is an herbivorous exclusion fence constructed with a permit from Talbot County. That shoreline is on the Monaco property. It's actually a foot back from the Monaco property, and that shoreline is eroded completely. This is a shoreline on the Tillman Beach Association. You can see the collapsed riprap from overtopping of the erosion. Here they are on the Tillman Beach property again, erosion contractor repairing the sill structure there. Fair to say the reasonable person would conclude that there is significant ongoing erosion and significant energy on that site that needs to be protected. I'm going to take you through two more with a little more detail. Again, we're going back to that overview of the slide, 72 wetland lines identified there. We took transects that referred to earlier, the data we developed over a three-year period, early 2009, a two-and-a-half-year period, early 2009 through 2011. What's happening is the wave action is attacking that vertical face. As it attacks the Phragmites are dying because of the salinity and the wave action. As the sand is then pushed through the Phragmites and back up into the land. It's can best be demonstrated here on this section drawing. Here was the elevation of the sand in 2009, that red line. Here's what we surveyed and confirmed in 2011. That's moved back. The sand has been pushed back. It's been elevated here, and it's filling in that tidal inlet. So we have not to digress for a minute and address the most egregious of the statements made earlier, we have not filled any wetland. There's been no wetland violation at all. What we have done is cleared the beach from debris that accumulates on a regular basis at that site. And I digress. Here's a picture of the beach as it now exists at low tide. You can see the Phragmites root mass is still in place. Notice the distance between that and the tidal inlet. Here is that tidal inlet. The Phragmites roots are still there. We did not see any new growth. One of the issues that was perhaps, I'd like to draw your attention to the surface hydrology in that area. Ms. Johnson mentioned that there is a significant rains events, and they have a lot of property that drains. Over time, sometime in the past, the outfall from that drainage has been directed onto the Monaco property and into the non-tidal wetlands. Don't know who did that. We certainly didn't. We didn't discover it until we started treating the Phragmites. Here's the results of that surface drainage. This is a picture 2 days or so after a major storm. You'll notice the the drainage back into that tidal inlet. That's not going back out to the shoreline. This is a higher area here that's draining from the tidal inlet. That is surface water runoff. When the storm is too severe, it'll overtop that occluded tidal inlet, and it will then cut a path through the existing sand out into the water. Issue of habitat. This is a shoreline at Eastern Shoreland Conservancy in January 2012, taken at apparently a different location and at a mean high water level. This is a shoreline at mean high water at the Monaco property. I'll direct your attention to the two-page document that I gave you that is included in your book. It addresses the issue of terrapin and horseshoe crab habitat. I'm not going to read through this entire thing, but we've listed our references on the second page of this, and chief among them is Rosenberg, who is the chief investigator on a research grant funded by the Army Corps of Engineers for Poplar Island. Poplar Island is about eight miles as the crow flies from this location. The sites that we list, 10 sites, are rife with statements that they're not going to breed in areas below mean high water.
Stop here. 10 sites, not this property?
I'm sorry, no, 10 citations from the literature.
Oh.
I'm sorry. And they go on to say that...
sites with a C, not with an S.
I'm sorry, yes.
My C's and E's today are getting me.
We'll call it a site. terrapins are, I'll read two. Terrapins are dramatically affected by loss of marsh habitat. Salt marshes, Spartina marshes, are critical foraging, nursery, and overwintering areas for diamondback terrapins, but marshes have been disappearing rapidly over the last 100 years. Witness Monaco residents. Salt marshes are extremely productive areas that serve as nurseries for a variety of species. And it goes on to say that...
Okay, yeah, we have that here. Thank you.
So,
do you have anything else?
Adequately address that.
Do you have anything else that you want to present?
No, I'd just like to correct that we are environmental concern.
Yeah.
That is our name.
No, we got that. We appreciate that. Okay, two things I want to do. One is on the issue of non-compliance proceeding with work that is not authorized while it's not rightfully appropriately before this board. Since it has been raised in a public venue, I'm going to ask that MDE, I'm assuming that's your MDE, where are you, MDE? That's your lane, that's your issue, and I've asked that you all look into that and just make sure that anything that's being done on the property is in compliance with approvals, permits, authorizations, et cetera.
Could I ask a question of MDE?
Mm-hmm.
Is any of this new to you, what you're hearing? We don't have in our backup information regarding a cease and desist order. I just want to make sure.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Comptroller Francho, and Lieutenant Governor Brown. Jay Sakai, representing the Department of the Environment. The short answer to your question is, no, none of this is new information. We've been through a process over the course of about 18 months, assessing this project. Ms. Monaco has... recommended what we think is a good project and good approach to the stabilization of the shoreline in front of her property. This process has gone through public review, public comment, and there's been, through that 18-month period of time, I think a very good attempt on the part of the applicant to try to address the concerns that have been raised. With respect to the allegations about non-compliant activity. We have been to the site. We investigated a number of times, up to four times that are in our records, not found problems with any problems with non-compliant activity. I'm not aware of a cease and desist order. The applicant is waiting for the approval of the board, the issuance of the license to proceed with the majority of the stabilization work. I do want to say that the legislature did, in fact, pass legislation several years ago that was, in effect, trying to promote marsh creation, living shoreline, and you're all familiar with that. This is an attempt, we think a very good attempt, that will result in a good environmental benefit, as opposed to doing a revetment or just a beach replenishment, and it will restore habitat in what we think is a very healthy way.
Okay, anything else from any other members of the board? Any members of the board?
I do have
Okay, please. Mm-hmm, that's fine.
DNR. Is this resolved or is it not?
Could I ask Greg Golden to come up and say a few words about it?
I'm told it's resolved here, and then we are told it's not truly resolved. I want to hear from you.
Good morning. Greg Golden, Director, Environmental Review Unit, Maryland Department of Natural Resources. We conducted a rigorous and vigorous review, and there was much, much content. At the end, or nearing the end of the review, we were asked, even by the agencies and Mr. Golden Moore, to put into a memo to explain exactly where we were at. And so the key statement in there is that following the meeting and additional discussions, the department agrees with MDE that the proposed shoreline protection project is a permittable design, and it goes back to the discussion of the importance of living shorelines and the extensive review work that was done by both Department of Natural Resources and Department of the Environment and the consultant. Therefore, and we had to state this clearly, therefore the department would not object to the proposed project being permitted by MDE. Just briefly, was there a lot of review information? Yes, there was. I'm a person of detail and integrity, and it was very important to me that in that it was quoted a summary document. It's very important to me that nobody does misunderstand that all issues were completely resolved. What we want Living Shorelines to be as a programmatic issue is the state of the art continually advanced, so that what we do this year will be very good, and what we do next year will have more information considered and into the future. And that's an important point, because the content of this review was a long review, and the content that was involved was to make not only a single project better, but the process into the future. And we put this memo out for Mr. Golden Moore and for MDE so that they understood where we were at.
So the bottom line is, as you stated, for this particular project at this particular time, DNR is supportive.
That's the tricky word. Not opposed, and agree it's a permittable design. And we were very careful. We had a meeting to discuss the wording because, you know, we want to be precise on that.
Sure.
I bet you.
And we comment on many projects throughout the state that are permitted, and there are many types of projects like this. And the difference between permitting agencies and commenting agencies are true. And that's playing out, you know, in our discussion here.
Is a wetlands license needed to clear out phragmites, to clear out invasive?
I'm going to defer that back to MDE.
Yes, ma'am.
No, typically not. There's a requirement to get a toxic materials permit, which was secured for that, the removal of that phragmites.
So there's no legal issue?
There's no license. There's no legal issue.
Okay.
Yeah. Sure.
And I know it's not the ballot, but.
So the question was whether or not, can you just restate the question, whether or not there is a requirement for a permit
for wetlands license.
Wetlands license.
To clear debris.
Well, no, not debris. No, to clear what?
Environmental Concern did have a buffer management plan to clear phragmites from the property. But that was well and away from the Sandy Beach area. I have an email from Elisa DeFlo, who works for Talbot County Government Planning and Zoning, who cleared up the issue of the buffer management plan permit that Mr. Schlier had stated was their authorization to go onto the beach and clear debris and actually to push the sand back. And she stated, no, that it had nothing to do with them being on the beach with a machine with a shovel attached pushing sand around. And I have her email that I'll be happy to give you a copy of. So that's why I was hoping that the board would at least defer a decision on this property now, because there are some issues that And you could tell how carefully Mr. Golden was speaking. They've repeatedly stated they don't think there's erosion. We think there is a problem with the design, and we respectfully request that the board at least defer a decision until some of these issues can be addressed a little more closely. Even though it's been 18 months, even though it's been a long time, we think there really needs to be a little more discussion. And I thank you very much for letting me battle on.
Last bite.
Gene Slear, environmental concern. There was never a cease and desist order issued. We have not trespassed on their property. The buffer management plan submitted to the Talbot County was for upland erosion. There was debris throughout the entire site, all the way up to the road. We received a permit from the Maryland Department of the Environment to treat the Phragmites and remove it from the beach. That's what we did. Then we did it under that permit.
And that's what MDE was.
Yeah, it's different divisions. It's not tidal wetlands. It's a toxic. But we operate consistent with that permit.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else from the board members on item number 5?
Did Mr. Moore to say something? He's standing there looking.
Mr. Moore, are you looking to say something, or you're here to respond to any questions or anything like that? Okay. Any other questions then of members of the board or comments? Okay, is there a motion on item number 5 of the secretary's agenda?
Move approval.
Comptroller moves approval. Seconded by the
Lieutenant Governor.
Lieutenant Governor. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Any opposed?
No, but I would have preferred a little more time to get some of the answers, although I don't think they would actually, in fact, change the situation. The woman came and is requesting a permit to do on her property what she can to protect her property in a legal way. So I will not object to it, but I will abstain because I think I can see.
Okay. So the comptroller withdraws the motion, and I have no objection as a seconder. And so the motion
is
to.
I just think some of these things should be answered on the record, although as I understand it, it is somebody seeking to do legally what is the right thing.
So the treasurer moves for a 2-week or until the next 3 weeks. And I'll second that. All those in favor say aye.
Only on the condition we don't go through.
Yeah. Yes. Well, we've heard the problem.
What we would like is a written response to the issues raised. Okay. Great. All in favor of the 3-week postponement, say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Here are none. We'll take that up in 3 weeks. Thank you for the information presented today. Let's take up the remainder of the Secretary's agenda. Madam Secretary, you're on.
We have 18 items this morning. We have 3 reports of emergency procurements. You've already deferred item 5, and we're ready for the rest of the items. Do you have any other questions?
Item four. Questions from the comptroller.
Item four. Again, it's Mr. Dolden Moore. That is a recommendation from the Wetlands Administrator, who has concurred with the recommendation of the Department of the Environment to grant a wetlands license to Unistar Operating Services. Mr. Moore.
Well, good. Again, good morning. It's like a doubleheader today here for you. Again, I'm Dolden Moore, Wetlands Administrator. For you today is Wetlands Case 08-1462, which is Unistar Operating Services, LLC, and Calvert Cliffs 3 Nuclear Project, LLC, are the applicants. This is a request for a license to construct structures that are associated with the construction of a 1,710 megawatt pressurized water nuclear reactor located on the Chesapeake Bay in Calvert Cliffs at the nuclear generation station. There are five elements to the project. The first is to construct an intake and an existing forebay by constructing a sheet pile wall and placing 100 linear feet of stone armor protection, mechanically dredging 900 square foot area to the minus 25 foot depth at mean low, and construct a trash rack and in place a stone revetment. The second element is to construct a new fish return by mechanically dredging an area to the minus 6 foot mean low and placing an 18 inch high density polyethylene pipe, and to construct a stone apron and place stone slash sand fill covering the HDPE pipe, and to place a stone revetment. The third element is to construct a discharge pipe by mechanically dredging an area to the minus 16.5-foot mean low and place 550 feet of 30-inch HDPE pipe, construct a stone scour pad, constructing a discharge diffuser, and in placing again stone sand fill covering the 30-inch HDPE pipe, and to place a stone revetment. The fourth element is to restore the existing barge unloading facility that has been there with the original Calvert Cliffs 1 and 2 and by mechanically dredging an area of 1,905 square feet to the minus depth of 16 feet, and also, again, to construct a steel pile wall and also construct a stone apron. The last element is to dispose of approximately 67,000 cubic yards of dredge material at an on-site approved disposal site. And today we do have representatives from Unistar and MDE to address any questions that the board may have. We have no one wishing to speak in opposition in granting of the license. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Comstock?
Yes, thank you. And thank you for that excellent presentation. I was just sitting here trying to wrap my head around the wetlands license we were just talking extensively about. And this one, because obviously we're talking significant amount of activity should we approve this moving forward. Is there some way for you to help me conceptualize how big this permit is compared to the one we just spent a lot of time talking about?
Quite a bit larger. The biggest component is really the dredging of the barge loading area, but a percentage of that, about half or so, was dredged back in the 70s when the plant was originally developed. There's no impact to resources in this area. It was a natural oyster bar back in the 70s, but that was mitigated at that time on it. So in terms of resource impacts, it's very minimal on the tidal side.
I was just being a little facetious.
I know.
Obviously, this permit that is before us is of enormous magnitude to the state, and frankly, to the country, because should this all move forward, I believe this would be the first nuclear reactor constructed in the United States for several generations or several decades at least. So just for the record, if I could understand a little bit more the circumstances that are surrounding this. It's my understanding that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the Maryland Department of the Environment, has studied this proposal significantly.
Correct.
They've had an opportunity to weigh in on the environmental and ecological
Correct.
Merits. Can you summarize those agencies and their positions on the proposal? And specifically, are both agencies confident that the project can proceed without doing damage to the bay, the marshlands, aquatic plants, seafood population, and the
if I may,
ecosystem?
Department of the Environment.
How many thousand cubic yards are we dredging here?
If you'll just bear with me, the yeah, 67,000 total cubic feet of material is being dredged. There's going to be a restoration of
cubic feet or cubic yards?
Cubic yards, I'm sorry. There will be a as part of the mitigation plan for the impact, particularly to those of the natural oyster bed, there will be a mitigation requirement associated with this license for the creation of 4.5 acres of shallow water habitat. Along the way, the impacts By the way, this has been a process that has gone on for about 40 months or so with the resource agencies. Evaluation of alternatives, minimization, looking at sites that would minimize the impact, and then mitigation for all of the title and non-title impacts along the way. So the answer is yes, we do believe that through the appropriate mitigation and constraints that are put in into this license and the permits, that the impacts to Maryland's natural resources will be fully mitigated for.
Okay. And my understanding is the project, not the permit, but the project is stalled right now as far as the new plans for a new nuclear power plant.
Yes, sir. That is our understanding. There is a, as you know, the development of nuclear power is a long process. This is one step in that process involving preparation of the site should a reactor be authorized. And as I'm sure you're aware, there has been there's going to be additional decision-making both by NRC and other agencies related to the development of that reactor. So there are other questions that have to be answered and other issues that have to be resolved prior to the construction of the reactor.
Okay. So, and I understand when Constellation pulled out of its partnership with EDF, which is the parent company of the applicant, Unistar, is that
right? Yeah, EDF is the parent company of Unistar Operating Services.
Right. And when that happened, under federal law, a foreign corporation or, frankly, any foreign citizen, national or government, cannot apply for a license to build a nuclear reactor in the U.S.
That's correct. And as a condition of the NRC license, they will have to secure a U.S. partner.
So, and I, obviously, that's good policy. But does that, are there any partnerships in the works that would get this project moving again? Should we approve this license?
I'm probably not the person to answer that question. Either perhaps the applicant or.
I'm happy to hear from the applicant, but let me, while I've got you, what is the, just for clarification, if the project can't proceed until EDF finds a U.S. partner, which I take it is the situation, why are we issuing the wetlands license at this time? Why don't we just wait and see whether they come up with a partner and the NRC is moving forward? It's kind of hard to put the stuff back once you take it out, right?
That is true, and I guess the answer to that is that because the development of facilities such as Reactor 3 proceed along a long timeline, regulatory and otherwise, that the environmental permitting, which would normally be addressed up front during the assessment stage, is part of that process early on. We would certainly expect that they still have to secure regulatory approval from the Corps of Engineers. They still have to secure regulatory approval from NRC, among others, for the development, so that we'd expect this to be part of that approval process, and that construction would not begin until they have secured both the U.S. partner and address all of the other issues associated with the license.
Oh, so the dredging and everything anticipated is going to be deferred until the project...
My understanding is that the construction will not proceed until the...
Okay, well, that's good information. And if the company wants to comment, is that the company's representative there?
Yeah, no, I think we should... some of those questions are probably better answered by Unistar.
Excellent.
Unistar's representative. So welcome, introduce yourself, and good morning.
Great to be here. My name is Ed Jarmus. I'm Senior Vice President of Unistar and General Manager of Copper Cliffs 3. Comptroller Francho, Governor Brown, Treasurer of COP. Once again, I'm here to represent Unistar and the project. I also have Dmitry Lachenkov attending with me, who can handle any of the technical questions along with questions that you have for the MDE. And also for the Title Wetlands Administrator. The one question I did want to respond to you that I heard, which is why should the board consider issuing, granting this wetlands permit at this point in time, I think needs to be addressed in context of the overall aspect where the project is. I heard the word stalled. I think the word stalled may be an overcharacterization of where we're at. I think one needs to realize that the project has expended over $500 million in development expenses to get us to where we're at. That is through a whole host of permitting activities, detailed design engineering activities, and primarily associated with the licensing activities at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is overseeing all the safety-related review for the project. One of the reasons we need a license issued at this time is to move forward on the issue that you raised, which is where are we in identifying the U.S. partner. When you have a project that has spent $500 million to date to get to where we're at, and you still have a few outstanding permits that need to be acquired that are critical to going forward with the project, this being one of them, it's absolutely critical that we represent to the U.S. partner that we have cleared those hurdles. So that is the primary reason that we are seeking this permit now, is to move forward with identifying and bringing in.
Is it your intent to do any work?
The answer that the MD provided is, would we go forward and impact the environment prior to having made a decision to go forward with the project, both from a commercial, economic perspective, and certainly also from an environmental perspective. It's not our position to go forward and perform these activities until we have made a decision to go forward with the project. And go forward with the project would entail us bringing in a U.S. partner, which we would need prior to having the NRC issue the combined operating license.
Thank you, Madam Treasurer, for asking that. I think that's an important piece of information. I have another issue while I've got you here that I'd like to just bring up. My notes tell me, and my recollection was, that there was a deal struck between Unistar and the AFL-CIO to construct this reactor under the terms of a project labor agreement?
That is correct.
I'm a huge fan of that, because I think you're going to get a good quality project on time, on budget, and obviously it helps Maryland trades. So I applaud you on that. Safety and reliability, I think, will be a result. But here's my question. What happens if, I think you had that arrangement a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you enter into a business relationship with a new U.S. partner that doesn't have my enthusiasm for project labor agreements?
Mm-hmm.
For whatever reason, are there safeguards baked into the PLA that you currently have that will keep those terms and conditions in place, regardless of who the new partner may be? I take it Bechtel is involved in this also somehow.
Great question. Absolutely correct. Bechtel is involved. Bechtel is a part of the consortium with Areva, Areva being the supplier of the nuclear technology, Bechtel being the constructor. Bechtel's been involved in more nuclear construction projects in the U.S. than any other contractor. So we feel very comfortable with Bechtel being the principal party to the project labor agreement. The project labor agreement is an agreement between Bechtel Construction and the various union members. We at Unistar have committed to the unions that we will also operate, even though we're not a signatory party to the project labor agreement, that we will also operate under the terms of the project labor agreement. We have a very strong relationship with the Washington Building and Construction Trades Department that would supply the union labor to build this facility. In fact, I talked to Vance Ayres, who's Secretary of the Building and Construction Trades, this morning. Explained to Vance that I couldn't attend a board meeting at the Construction Commerce Council because I would be here. Vance had offered to me, would it help if he was here in helping to move the permit process forward, or would it help if he would contact the Board of Public Works in support of this project? I indicated to Vance I very much appreciated that, but I didn't feel it was necessary at this time. The reason I bring that example up as recently as this morning is I think it just exemplifies the relationship that we have with the unions And we are certainly going to do everything it takes on our part to make sure that that stays in place. Bechtel, who remains our primary contractor, has the agreement with the unions. And regardless of who the new partner may be, it's going to be Unistar's position that there is tremendous value there for the reasons that you raise: safety, reliability, on time, and an on budget type performance.
So it sounds to me as if, regardless of who the new partner might be, that PLA will stay in place based on your testimony.
We're committed to keeping it in place.
Okay. Then just finally, you know, I understand all the policy arguments in favor of nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a huge fan of that on the merits. I think that there are lots of issues involved, and obviously Japan and Three Mile Island and all these other incidents bring some of those concerns. But my major concern right here today is with the ratepayers. Do you have any perspective on, putting aside my philosophical concerns with nuclear power, what is the impact on the ratepayer of building this enormous project as far as typical utility bills for Marylanders?
Yeah, well, the project is currently structured as a merchant facility. So under the current structure, there is no established rate base and corresponding impact to rate payers. Okay? That's the first part of my answer. The second part of the answer is that to the extent we within the state of Maryland want to bring in essentially green carbon-free baseload generation, which is not solar or wind, because eventually you do get to the point where you do need 24/7 baseload power to fill the gap. And it's not coal, and perhaps it's not natural gas, which has 60% of the carbon emissions of a coal plant, so you still have carbon emissions, that we work towards a solution, and certainly not for the, you know, it's not the topic necessarily for this meeting, and I'm not proposing a solution, but that the state of Maryland and the federal bodies work through whether it's a carbon tax or some type of mechanism to make the project more attractive to the state of Maryland. Because the opportunities for a nuclear project within the state of Maryland are enormous from an environmental perspective and certainly from a job perspective as well.
I want to hire you guys to help with the coal industry and the poultry industry, because if you're able to make that case about nuclear, I'm impressed by the strength of your presentation. I'm kidding, obviously, but am I right that this would be the first new reactor in the U.S., or am I got my facts mixed up there?
We could say you're absolutely right if we say it's the first nuclear merchant reactor, because Southern Company is in the process of constructing Vogtle in Georgia. They've pretty much concluded their site pre-construction activities, and they're very close to starting their safety-related construction. I quantify it as a much different type of facility because it is purely a rate-based facility within Southern Companies in Georgia. It does have a DOE loan guarantee commitment, so that project is going forward and is ahead of us. So there's a strong possibility that if things work in our favor, that we have a project that could come online as either, you know, roughly number two or number three in the U.S.
And just finally, if you do find a U.S. partner and it moves forward, what kind of subsidies or loans are we talking about? For example, what Southern received for their project, and is that similar in scope?
One of the most critical aspects, I mean, there are a couple things that would underpin us going forward, and that's why it's important in issuing this permit. It's not like we receive the wetlands permit from the Board of Public Works and the Maryland Department of Environment for the non-tidal portion and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and we go forward with site pre-construction activities. That's certainly not the case, because we need a couple other things to come together. And one of the principal things that we need is securing the funding for this project. And to be able to secure the funding is to be able to come to acceptable terms with the Department of Energy Loan Guarantee Program. We have a loan guarantee application on file. That's an application that Southern Company had. Southern Company, I believe, was awarded $8.33 billion of loan guarantees. It's not actually a loan. It's just guaranteed that that loan will be repaid. We are seeking a similar, not necessarily in size, but a similar loan guarantee through the Department of Energy, and we're actively engaged in that process now. And that's just another example for us to move forward with the loan guarantee process in the DOE. We continue to need to represent to the DOE our progress in moving permitting processes forward, NRC licensing processes forward. We have to represent that we are a real project. And we are doing that. And we are providing the Department of Energy 90-day updates on where we're at. And it would certainly be a very positive event for us on our next 90-day update to the Department of Energy to clearly state that we have received permits both from BPW, MDE, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers.
Thank you. Anything else? Okay. Anything, Madam Treasurer?
Just so we have here on our application four bullets, including reconstructing a barge runoff load facility, which then requires. It's not your intention to do that prior to the go-ahead for building a new building.
That's correct. Plant.
I'm not saying for or against doing that. I happen to be a proponent of nuclear energy, however. I wish you well. Thank you.
No. Thank you.
Given your, you certainly have spent a lot of resources in this project. You've got a pretty good handle on the timeline. If you meet all your gates and your approvals with, make assumptions for delays, when would be the earliest you think that you would do any work pursuant to the permit that this board might approve today?
Yeah, that's a difficult question because the answer is highly speculative since it's driven by a number of factors that need to come together.
By getting the U.S. partner.
And getting a U.S. partner is the one. But the three items that really need to come together to be able to drive the negotiations with the U.S. partner as quickly as possible is the position that we have with the Department of Energy on the loan guarantee program, the due diligence process that the U.S. partner would have to go through by proving that the project is ready to go and that there is the economic viability associated with the project, that there is some realization of a regulatory framework both within the state of Maryland and a little bit broader when I say carbon tax, that makes the project economically viable. When those come together, then our sponsor, our parent, EDF, would have to make the decision to give the green light to go forward or not.
Great, because what I just heard was you're not going to be disrupting the environment unless this thing is really viable and going forward.
That is correct.
Any other questions or comments from the board?
I'm going to reluctantly vote for this despite my concerns. And the concerns I have, a lot of them are just economic. I mean, type of loan guarantees, they're just huge, and take it you can't get private sector capital for this. This all has to be guaranteed by the taxpayers.
So, aren't you getting private sector capital that is then guaranteed by the public sector, right?
That's
you're not
correct.
Getting public sector
right.
capital.
I'm saying
that's correct.
Yeah. Okay, I'm sorry.
Again. The monies that would be available.
Private sector capital without a taxpayer guarantee.
Well, the monies that would be available from the Federal Financing Bank would be guaranteed by the Loan Guarantee Office. But it's all driven. Once you do have that loan guarantee, then a number of financing options do open up.
But the industry, I take it, is not viable without the federal loan guarantee.
That's correct.
Well, that, among other things, is my concern with the sector. But having said that, I appreciate the project labor agreement. I think that's a very commendable step. And on your testimony that's going to stay in place, I'm going to vote for this.
Anything else from...
I'm curiosity. Maybe an unfair question. you have a very active company. One aspect is this Calvert Cliffs. Are you doing anything as a corporation to forward the efforts towards cap and trade, carbon tax, recapture?
Yeah. Unistar, we're very focused on the development of Calvert Cliffs 3 from a project development standpoint. We are also engaged, and that activity occurs more at the, what I would say, the parent level, EDF Inc. out of Chevy Chase, Maryland, in what I would view as kind of the public forum in impacting policy, perhaps influencing policy, stating positions. So our parent is, but Unistar is not necessarily that active on that front because we are very focused on kind of the development, what needs to happen to be able to move this project forward.
But you do agree that until the total cost of energy is incorporated one way or another in the price, in the pricing mechanism, it's going to be very difficult to do anything except continue polluting.
Absolutely, and I think unless we get to that point where we increase the economic viability of baseload green power projects, and when we say baseload green power, I think we're talking only nuclear. Coal doesn't satisfy it, gas doesn't satisfy it, and certainly wind and solar don't satisfy that because they're not baseload. That we, as a country,
unless
will
there's
need
a new storage capacity for, I mean, possible.
Yes. Good technical point, an option that's currently not available. But, yeah, absolutely.
I think it's going to require a great deal of work on the part of knowledgeable folks in the private sector to push for a good pricing mechanism before it's too late.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That's just an editorial, I probably.
No, it's very insightful. Anything else, though?
Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Okay, why don't we take this item up? Motion to approve made by the comptroller.
Why don't we have the treasurer like that?
Oh, that's right. She's a big proponent of nuclear. That's right. I'll step out. Motion made by the chair for today. Seconded by the.
It would be an honor.
That's my arm wrestle. That one. Okay, by the treasurer. All those in favor, say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Okay, hearing none, item 5 on the Secretary's agenda is approved. And why don't we...
Four.
I'm way off today. Sorry. Okay, item 4. Okay, let's take up the rest of the Secretary's agenda. Are there any other issues or requests for information, discussion on any of the other items of the Secretary's agenda?
No.
Okay, hearing none, the Treasurer moves, the Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor say aye. Aye. All those opposed, hearing none, Secretary's agenda is approved. Let's move next to, in order, DNR, real property. Hold on, is that, I'm sorry, Madam Treasurer, Secretary, does that include the appendix item?
It did include the appendix item.
Okay, okay.
We also did have a request. Oh, sorry, item 17 was the African American Heritage Program.
Right.
We have a couple good grants there. There were some people to present some pictures. I don't know if you want to go on.
Were they signed up to present?
No, it's the item of the agency.
Okay, but I think we ought to take it anyway.
I think
absolutely. Absolutely. So we've already approved it. That's
right,
fine.
Right, but item 17 and it's Ann Raines is here.
Okay, they have been approved, so you don't have to convince us, but certainly we want to experience the presentation.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I think it's your morning. I have with me today three projects that we're working on, and I would like for Ann Raines, the head of this project on the other side of our partnership. She's from the Maryland Historical Trust, and, of course, we're the Maryland African American History and Culture Program that's operating this grant program. Ann?
Thank you for allowing us a couple minutes. We do have some guests here from each of the projects, and I know that the board has expressed a lot of interest in this program. So without further ado, I'll ask each of our grantees to be brief in describing their projects. But first I'll introduce Herschel Johnson, who is the president of the Francis Stanley Institute. This is quite an exciting project for the renovation of Christ Rock Methodist Episcopal Church, which is no longer an active church. It's in use as a museum. And actually, if anybody wants to come out for the popcorn, this building is going to have to be lifted off its foundations. And I said I'd bring refreshments. So if anybody wants to see it, it's happening. So, Herschel, please.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor Brown and members of the board. I am from Cambridge, Dorchester County, and we live in a little sub-community called Christ Rock, where the Christ United Methodist Church was given to the members of the Friends of Stanley Institute, our organization. We got our name for the Friends of Stanley Institute, and in 1998, we got a bond bill to restore Stanley Institute, which is a one-room school built in 1867 and taught African-American children from 1867 to 1962. We are located on Route 16, which is now the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad. And the church that we are restoring now was built in 1875. And it is 8.6 miles away from the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad National State Park. This project is something that will be, when it's finished, we'll have two complexes, the school and then the church across the road. And we intend to have an interpretive program that will tell the story of the community and of in 1857 when 45 slaves ran away from Dorchester County. They ran away from Town Point, which is just down the road from where we are located. And we intend to tell that story where the slaves were successful to run away from Dorchester County. And there were one free woman and her son, along with the member of those 45 slaves. We hope to be... do an interpretive plan about the slaves, and it will be a great tourist attraction when, and we hope to be finished in 2013, because that's about the time that they break ground for the Harriet Tubman Underground Railroad Park. So we are glad to be here today and hope that it will be approved. Thank you.
Do you have any idea, did you trace what happened to them after they left Dorchester County?
Yes. Most of them, the slaves, when they escaped, they went to Canada. And they left some of we are in the process. Some of the names that ran away were, well, I'll have to give you one, Stanley. We're trying to trace if that was related to Ezekiel Stanley, where we got the name of the school in 1867. And one thing about that school, it was a community-owned school, and it has continued to be a community-owned school up to the day.
150 years.
Yes.
Thank you.
Oh. The Kunta Kinte Alex Haley Memorial is something probably all familiar with, and we've all seen in the newspaper how whenever there's a strong wind or a lot of rain or hurricane, it gets flooded, and all you see is the very top of Alex Haley's head. So the next project is the Kunta Kinte Alex Haley Memorial Improvement. The foundation is represented by Board Chair Lisa Treadwell Lane and Board Member Patsy Blackshear.
Thank you for allowing us to testify this morning on behalf of the project that we consider very important to the Annapolis, actually to Maryland, and is near and dear to our hearts. Yes, we all have seen the devastation of the impact of tropical storms and hurricanes like Isabel. I have a picture of the statue with the water up to its neck. But the statue grouping is only one of various components that's a part of the memorial. The memorial includes that statue grouping that includes Alex Haley and three children, but it also includes 10 bronze on stone plaques that make up the story wall. You might have seen the story wall that has statements from the book Roots with interpretive information from a nationally known writer. It also includes a compass rose, and the compass rose has associated metal benches and an interpretive display. And finally, it includes a webcam, and the webcam allows us to connect with the world through live video access. So we're very excited about this project, and although we maintain it as best we can, we're constantly seeking additional resources so we can conserve it properly. These resources, the $36,000, which you've already approved, we thank you very much, will allow us to clean and protect all bronze components of the memorial with hot wax treatment. It will allow us to clean, repair, and re-caulk, as necessary, all stone components, and you can see those areas needing re-caulking when you look at the story wall. It will allow us to replace our failing lighting system. The memorial looks very nice when it's lit at night. Our lighting has been failing. We want to replace that lighting system. And finally, we get emails on our website quite often when our webcam goes down. It goes down often. So it will allow us to upgrade our webcam. People access that webcam from all over the world, not just the United States. So the blizzards, the 2010, which was a century-making blizzard, the tropical storms and hurricanes, the many touches and hands that interact with the statue grouping, because interacting with the memorial and taking pictures is a favorite pastime for many visitors to Annapolis City docks. Those things have created the need and for us to not only provide ongoing maintenance, but for us to conserve this major piece of work. Our last major conservation effort was in 2004, and with these resources, we will be coordinating our effort with the Maryland Historic Trust Society, as well as Nancy Kurtz, who is experienced in conserving military monuments, and Gary Schwartzer. Gary was our interpretive architect who helped us with the website design when this whole plan was laid out. So we're very pleased to have that kind of technical support. We look forward to moving ahead as quickly as we can now that you've approved it.
Thank you.
Questions?
I would just like to point out that I think all of the three of the sitting members of the Board of Public Works today had the pleasure and honor of voting originally to create the memorial. And we're certainly interested in its preservation and protection.
We thank you for your continued support.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And on behalf of the old Pamunkey High School, the Pamunkey High School Alumni Association, we have here Philip Thomas and Joseph Johnson.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Board. I apologize. I'm somewhat unprepared because my great-grandson had my attention this morning and I picked up the wrong notes. But nevertheless, I'm the president of the Pamunkey High School Alumni Association, which is located in Charles County, Maryland. And I'd like to thank the Maryland Historical Trust as well as the African American Preservation Society for their effort, and we appreciate the award and the grant for the restoration of the first African American high school in Charles County. I do have some notes, and I'd like to make these following comments. The original Pamunkey High School was the first high school in Charles County for black students and opened in 1922. The school was later enlarged and continued in operation until 1969. The school opened its doors of education to many black students who had few opportunities for education in the rural area. Before the school opened, black students had to move to Baltimore and Washington, D.C. to pursue an education. This grant will allow for historic structure studies, architectural designs, and engineering plans to transform the old school building and grounds into a community center with a small museum for the display of artifacts and photos associated with the history of African Americans in Charles County, as well as the history of so-called colored schools in Southern Maryland. I especially like to thank Ms. Ann Raines for her direction and her support. Thank you.
Thank you. I should add that Delegate Murphy was here today in support of this, he did not ask to speak, but to defend it vigorously if the board was inclined to oppose it or to deny it. But thank you for your presentation. Any other questions or comments from the board? Okay, well, thank you very much. And as you know, it has been approved. This item has been approved, but we really do appreciate your giving us some background information on the good work that is going to be done with this grant money.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, and as you see, the money is spread throughout the state because we start on the Eastern Shore with Dorchester County, Anne Arundel County, and Charles County. Mm-hmm. And this is a continuing process, and it is paying great dividends in the school system because of this effort, the history and the preservation of this history is going to be maintained through the school system.
Thank you.
Thank you for your hard work.
Okay, let's call the Department of Natural Resources Real Property Agenda.
Good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Lisa Ward for DNR. If I could have your attention for just about 30 seconds to share some very good news with you. Yesterday, DNR was advised that we had been awarded a $1 million grant from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The grant to improve water quality and wildlife around the chomp tank. Not only is it good news for us, but we are able to use the recently approved Point Pleasant easement as a state match for the federal grant. Today we have two items for your approval.
That's good news.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
Both the fact that we got that award and that there are only two items. Any questions or comments on DNR Real Property Agenda?
I trust the public will see news about the award.
Yeah, actually it was in the Sun paper this morning.
Yeah.
Okay. Treasurer moves approval. Seconded by the Comptroller. All those in favor say aye.
Thank you.
Aye. Any opposed? None. DNRRP approved. Thank you. And now we're going to DBM. Is that right? Okay.
Okay,
Madam Secretary.
Good morning. Members of the board, there are seven items on the Department of Budget and Management's agenda for today, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Do you have a walk-on, or what do they call it? Is that a walk-off on baseball,
right,
or walk-on on the Board of Public Works? What do you call it?
Hand carrot?
A hand carrot.
Okay. So is that before us?
No.
No. I thought with the lengthy sort of presentations we had that you would have been here by now. Do you think you'll be here before we're done?
No.
Okay. Do we need to talk about that item?
No.
Okay. Good. So, DBM.
So we have seven items. I'll be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Yeah.
I think there's a question about number one.
Yeah.
Actually. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Item number one is a contract to provide professional communication and related services to raise awareness and educate the public about the ICC. Beverly Hill, who is Director of Procurement from MTA, is here to answer any questions that you may have.
Could you? Good morning. I'm Beverly Hill, Director of Procurement Statutory Program Compliance. For the Maryland Transportation Authority, it's introduced, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, could you just sort of
describe what the function is, what will be done with this contract, first of all, why it's needed and what the company will do, and secondly, the question of why it was so important that the technical outweigh the financial in the award.
We use this contract to do several things. You know, public information obviously is very important in the transportation industry, and we have routine issues where it's important that we communicate to the public issues regarding our roadways. But in addition to that, this, as you know, we just opened the ICC, which is a new facility, and it's the first new facility we have opened in quite a while. We have projects up on I-95. So in addition to the normal day-to-day operations, things like Chesapeake Bay congestion, Chesapeake Bay Bridge congestion and all those things, we also have issues that come before us now requiring very timely or instant response and advice to the public. Public safety issues. In addition to, as I stated before, the new markets involved with the ICC in areas that we've not had tolling before, i.e. Prince George's, Montgomery County. So this time it was important for us to find a contractor that not only could assist us in our normal day-to-day operation, but also could help us prepare for emerging issues that we've not had before. This company, which is a minority-owned company, is very experienced in not only the transportation industry, but also in the tolling industry, which has unique needs other than different from other transportation
industries. So just hands up, what will it be doing regarding the tolls on the ICC?
It provides public, in relationship to the ICC, it provides normal public information, how to use the system, which we have not done before in those areas.
So press stories? I mean, what actually does it do?
The contract itself.
The contract and the contract door, what will it actually be doing?
The marketing campaigns that I think you've probably heard about the ICC, that's what this contract will do. In addition to that, because this is all electronic, people are not used to it before, we anticipate that there will be a need for instant information. Like if something happens on that roadway, you know, the Washington area is extremely congested as far as traffic. It is necessary for us, we anticipate it being necessary, to get instant information out there, knowing what markets we need to advertise in, how to get the information out, how to get customers to understand how to best use the roadway.
So how will they do that?
They will use marketing campaigns, the creative concept. They will design and help develop marketing campaigns. And then they will identify the right media markets, and then they will...
So if there's an emergency and you want them, they will get the word out about the emergency? Is that
yes,
what you're saying?
They will help us they will help us get the word out as far as emergencies. They will
by calling radio stations or by what exactly?
Well, the thing about this contract and most of our
or another example. It doesn't have to be this example. Just tell me what this company is going to be doing, because what people are saying is that they're going to advertise the fact that there is a Bay Bridge. And who needs that advertising? So what I would like to know is what exactly, in fact, will they be doing?
Well, one of the things that they will be doing is helping us to address issues that we have not anticipated. And I'll go back to the ICC. Not that it is something different than a toll operation, but because we've not had a new facility
right.
in quite a while. So the questions and the response that the public is asking, would ask for, is different than what we've had in the past. People are used to the, you know, the tunnels and the bridges. This is something new. They have their ability to help us not only identify the market, but also to how best to respond to it.
I have a question.
Or bay safety and traffic management, what that means.
Beverly Swain-Staley, if I can help. Unfortunately, I think Beverly has the disadvantage of not being in the press and the marketing, as she's in the procurement officer. But, for example, I know we'll be doing the same kinds of things that we do every year with regard to Bay Bridge, but also particularly with the ICC. So, for example, when the summer season begins, you hear a lot of extra advertisements around the Bay Bridge regarding best times to travel and those kinds of marketing campaigns. To help people, help people make options. I mean, whether perhaps going, north of Baltimore or south, the times, most frequent, best times to use those kinds of things. That's just one example of the kinds of things that these marketing firms do. And so in this case, I think one of the priorities here was not just our regular facilities, but for the ICC to do the same kinds of things because the ICC is a very new roadway. So it's identifying the media market, helping actually develop the media campaigns, writing the campaigns, distributing those kinds of things.
But about specific, not simply there is an ICC, although
no.
The ICC, it's new, yeah. I understand. Here's how it operates.
Promoting, but also, yes, helping people understand how to use it, the fact that we don't have, it's all electronic, so you need to get an easy pass, those kinds of things, so it's a different type of facility.
I have some questions about financial factors versus technical factors, and I see at Pinnacle Communications, their price came in at 50% less than the proposed awardee, Pulsar Advertising. What are the technical factors in what just appears to be not to be a fairly a highly technical or complicated, sophisticated service or requirement here. Can you just kind of sort of convince me that we should pay 50% more because Pulsar is so technically competent and superior?
Well, there were six evaluation factors, including economic benefit. Pulsar provided a superior proposal. As far as experience, they had more experience. They had specific experience in the tolling industry. Their staff had more experience. They also provided more assets. They can pull from another office, which the other companies did not have the same level of assets. They came very prepared and presented a marketing campaign in their proposal. They were prepared to respond to the public awareness campaigns that we currently have, as well as proposals for innovative ideas for the future.
So do we need the Steinway versus the Baldwin here? Why is everyone laughing? I only read about it. I wasn't here.
When it comes to the normal day-to-day operations, a lot of companies can do this kind of work. But when we have a major incident, things that have not happened before, it is important, more important than we think, because we ask a lot of questions. It's more important than we think to have a company that really knows how to respond, especially when it comes to public safety, as well as the day-to-day issues, the Bay Bridges, traffic, and all of those things. This company really did demonstrate a superior level of preparedness to respond to any type of situation that we could anticipate. We also have a representative of the company if you have any additional questions of the company.
Before that, let me just ask, is there an incumbent, not for the ICC, but for this service on other facilities, is there an incumbent
The incumbent is no longer in business, the company that previously had the
contract. And is that why we're going out, or because that company is no longer in business, or because the term would have expired anyway on that?
The term was expired anyway.
And
been doing for the last year?
Yeah, okay, that's the few questions. What have we been doing for the last few months, or however long the incumbent has not been around or doing business? And then the other question is, do any of the other offerors have experience in Maryland?
They have experience. They don't have the level of experience that this company demonstrated.
In Maryland, I mean.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Some of the other companies did have experience in Maryland. In fact, some of yes, they had experience.
And does Pulsar has experience in Maryland?
Yes.
For MDTA?
We've not used Pulsar before, but the other agencies have used them.
Okay. Anybody else have any other questions?
Yes. No, I share some of the, I think, the Lieutenant Governor and the Treasurer bringing up. It's a four-year, $2.3 million contract to Pulsar, and I don't know Pulsar other than that they're located in D.C., and I'm sure they're a good company. But my concern is that they're not only the high bidder, they're a high bidder of five firms that competed for the contract, and we're going to bypass three successful Maryland-based firms that submitted considerably lower bids than Pulsar. So I guess my question is, it's not particularly convincing to me so far, but how do you justify giving taxpayer dollars to a D.C.-based firm when Integrated Designs out of Glen Burnie would do the work for 12.7% less, when Sequis, if I'm pronouncing that right, of Baltimore is coming in 22.3% under the winning bid, or when Pinnacle Communications, as the Lieutenant Governor cited, submitted a bid that is 33% lower than Pulsar? That strikes me as kind of two strikes against this. One, we're not taking advantage of the best deal on the market, which is the point of our competitive bid process, but we're also missing an opportunity to provide Maryland-based companies with work that will create jobs and economic activity right here in Maryland. Can you comment again? This really goes to this question of technical versus financial, I guess. But I notice in your revised presentation to us, you now are saying the technical outweighs the financial, and before it was technical's equal with financial. This thing that we just received. But anyway, how do you justify that to the Maryland taxpayers particularly when they read in the Post all the time about Maryland companies being rejected by D.C. for, Maryland companies that are low bidders? Good Maryland companies with good Maryland citizens. And instead, we end up with this thing where a very high bid from an out-of-state company is given the contract.
I would ask Beverly to address why this particular firm was the best in terms. Obviously, the selection committee couldn't take into consideration where the firms were from, legally. But so I didn't really go there. But with regard to why that particular firm was deemed to be so much better, I'd defer back to Ms. Hill.
Yeah, that's really what the Treasurer was getting at. What is it that this company does as far as its press releases and its response to you that is significantly better than, for example, Integrated Designs? And Integrated Designs has a long, distinguished track record of working with both you and the State Highway Administration on a broad range of public outreach campaigns. The company's received several awards for the quality of its work. On the company's website, it says Wendy Emmerich and her staff have always provided timely, professional, attractive, and reasonably priced services and have done so with a true mutual spirit of cooperation. That quote was from Richard Solly, Director of Marketing for the MTA. I'm not that familiar with Sequest. I just don't recognize them. But, you know, on their website, they have a long list of private and public sector clients in Maryland, Maryland General Hospital, University of Maryland Athletic Department. Pinnacle includes their clients are Johns Hopkins and others. I mean, marketing services are important, I agree, but why are the technical considerations so heavily weighted here over financial, I guess?
There, when we ask some of the same questions, as you know, procurement people respond to requests within the organization. Again, the subject matter experts or the communications office that requested this contract provided several examples of why it was important to have experienced marketing and communications firms that could respond to our transportation needs.
Is there anyone from the operating section?
Given all the questions and concerns, if it pleases the board, I would, as the authority chairman, be willing to pull this item so we address.
Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, I was not aware when my briefing yesterday that we had these issues, and unfortunately, I was not at the authority meeting because of my injury. But I would be happy to meet with you, to go back, look at this. We'll come back and meet with you all because obviously there's a number of issues.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's see. Still on DBM. Any questions or discussion on any of the other items on DBM's agenda?
Move approval.
Okay. Hearing none. The comptroller moves approval. Seconded by the treasurer. All those in favor. Minus item at one. Say aye. Aye. Any opposed? Hearing none. DBM minus item one is approved. USM.
Good afternoon, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Jim Sterling for the University System of Maryland. We have one item on today's agenda. I'd be happy to address any questions.
I have an item.
Yes,
Thank you, Governor Brown. So we're being asked in item 1-RP to approve a request from the University of Maryland College Park to allow the demolition of the president's residence to proceed. I guess my first question is just procedural. Ms. McDonald, what is it that we're being asked to approve here?
The change in the use of the property, the substantial change in the use of the property under Department of Planning regulations. It stems from the board's authority to review and approve the transfer of any property. And since this is a demolition of property, it traditionally comes to the board.
Okay, there's a contract. Is a contract that we're approving?
Actually, there is no contract. This is simply the permission to demolish it, and I believe that the construction contractor is all being done by the foundation.
That's correct.
The Board of Public Works does not have. They're doing that on their own. That will not come to the board. The only thing here is nothing to do with the new project or the new home. It's to do with the demolition of the old home. And I understand that the old building, the new building is not going on top of the footprint.
It's nearby.
It's nearby, so it actually is a separate part of the.
Did the state build this building?
Let me ask our Vice President for Facilities Management to address that. I'm not sure what the history is. It was built back in the 50s. Mr. Carlo Coelho.
Good afternoon, members of the board. The existing building was built in 1956, and I'm not certain if it was built by state dollars or not.
Canada. So is this just as...
It is a state property. How it was constructed and funded in 1956, I don't have the answer to.
Okay. Well, this is thank you, Madam Treasurer, for asking that. Obviously, George Washington didn't sleep in this building.
No, in fact, the Maryland Historic Trust had no action recommended on this.
Okay, and you're not, they're not in the process of demolishing the building as we speak, I take it.
That was, no.
Okay, so we're being asked to approve the demolition. I appreciate you coming here because I take it the new building that you're planning, is that under construction already?
There's some startup work. I can have Brody Remington, our president of the College Park Foundation, come up and talk to that project. We're not handling the contract with
the
foundation.
And that's not coming before us. But I guess since we do have the demolition before us, this quote that the house is no longer suitable for functioning as both a residence and as a venue for important events hosted by the president, and it goes on to state that the current residence does not meet life safety codes. Can someone comment on the, or elaborate on what the issues are that have apparently rendered the current residence uninhabitable?
Sure. I'm going to ask Mr. Colella to come up again.
I think the key word is uninhabitable. Many of us have been over to this home. It's like, it's a beautiful home. And, or at least it always looked beautiful when I went in it. It was somewhat Monticello-like. I'm thinking of the home that's on top of the hill with the long driveway going up.
That's the home. Okay. It's a colonial-style home, again, built in 1956. I think the condition is a testament to our ongoing maintenance efforts to keep it functional through that period of time. The in terms of code, no longer meeting code, what that refers to is in current building codes, for example, the facility is not handicap accessible fully, as will the new facility be. Similarly, there are asbestos materials within the building itself. The building is not sprinklered or have sort of current, would not meet current codes if it were newly constructed. So the condition of the facility, and it's sort of obsolete. In the 1950s, it served fine, I'd say, as a residence. The event space is converted garage, actually, so it doesn't function very well for a modern-day president to host the events that is part of today's job as a university president.
Okay, so the house is 55 years old.
Right.
I live in a house that's 115 years old, and a lot of people probably have homes that are older than 55 years old. I guess the question I have is, how did you let the maintenance and upkeep of the house get in the kind of condition where you're suggesting that we, instead of renovating it or doing things that all of us do in our homes, why are we demolishing it?
When we went forward with the foundation seeking proposers to evaluate either the renovation and addition or the replacement of the facility, all of the finalists, there were five proposers who came forward, and each of the five proposers felt it was trying to build upon the existing residence was not economically warranted and would limit the ability of the facility to serve its function. So it's the condition of the facility itself, it was habitable, obviously, for a long period of time, but in terms of creating the kind of space and hosting the kinds of functions that are that occur regularly, it really wasn't functional for that perspective.
Okay, so the house is being demolished in order to create a place to hold functions, and then we're going to build a new house.
It's a dual-function facility, so the entire facility, the new facility, is about 14,000 square feet, of which about 4,000 square feet is the private residential quarters. The remainder of the facility is event space and public hosting space.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that, but I think it, for me, it's emblematic of just a maybe it's a disposable culture we live in where somebody says we need to do something slightly different, so we're going to throw this out and do the different thing and then rebuild the original place. And I'm aware that you're using foundation money, but doesn't the foundation exist to advance the core mission of College Park?
It does, and I could invite the foundation president to speak to that point if you'd like.
Well, the question I have, the Lieutenant Governor brought up Steinway Pianos at Bowie State that I correctly raised my hand. I'll ask the same question here. Is this the most timely and best use of your institutional dollars?
It's not the institution.
I was going to say it's the foundation, and I think that question would be better addressed by foundation president, Mr. Burgess.
Good afternoon. Brody Remington, president of the University of Maryland College Park Foundation, members of the Board of Public Works. The foundation Board of Trustees looked at the current residence very rigorously and engaged architects and engineers, and as Carlo Coella indicated, determined that it would be just as expensive to renovate and expand the current residence and still result in a much less functional and efficient space. And so it was determined to start from scratch and build a new facility that could meet the hosting and event needs of the university and the succession of president's residential space. We believe, the Board of Trustees of the Foundation believes, that this will have a considerable return on investment for what the foundation funds are put into this project, will result in substantial increased fundraising and other benefits for the university.
Okay. What is the cost of the project?
$7.2 million.
Okay. And didn't I read recently that College Park is planning to eliminate several Division I sports?
That is correct.
So your foundation are going to pay $7.2 million for a new mansion, and
alumni and friends of the university are giving to the foundation to support this particular project with the belief that it will bring in over many years in a continuing way new gifts and support for the university, including the Division of Athletics.
Okay, so you view this mansion as a higher priority, I take it, or wouldn't be before us today.
Well, we are also working with alumni to raise funds currently for athletics in support of the teams that are scheduled to be eliminated. So we don't view this as competition. Alumni and friends tend to support particular projects and programs that they identify with most closely. And we're asking people to step forward for athletics, as we are also asking other people to step forward for University House.
So this is a campaign that you initiated to raise $7.2 million for the mansion, to get a new mansion.
What we're calling University House, which has event space as well as residential space, yes.
So you have to appreciate the, I guess it's the contrast with, you know, all of the things going on. Your college education costs are going higher. The university is obviously out trying to save every penny it can. And yet we have an item before us to tear down a perfectly nice building. I've been in it several times, and it's clearly habitable. And yet it's being demolished. I just don't see the way in which you justify that to either your constituents or, frankly, our constituents who are interested in it from a, obviously have a major stake in flagship campus.
If I may respond with two
Please.
Points. One is reiterating that we are convinced that there will be a substantial return on investment, more gifts, more support of various kinds for the benefit of all the University of Maryland College Park. And I should wish to point out that Patsy Mope, the wife of the recently retired Dan Mope, president of Dan Mope, did a wonderful job over 12 years of camouflaging all the flaws in the house. Every time we had an event for more than 50 people, we needed to use tents, and very expensive for purposes of the events.
Could I just interrupt to say that I believe that Debbie Toll, some administrations before that, also went through the same thing.
Yes, back to 1956, I'm sure.
Well, not quite.
So, in order to avoid tents, we're going to demolish the mansion and build a new mansion with, I take it, some kind of facility.
It's
maybe it's the timing, maybe it's the bad economy, maybe it's the Steinway thing that got me ginned up a while ago, but this just strikes me as really an unfortunate project given the climate. I mean, this is a 55-year-old mansion. It's a beautiful building. Maybe you had to bring a tent in a couple of times a year for an event, but it's not a, if I could, it just doesn't strike me as a paramount priority. And so I'm going to vote against it, but I'm not sure what I'm voting against. I guess the wrecking ball is out there poised, but I would urge you to reconsider this because it doesn't look good.
Okay, let me say that, I am, perhaps pleased that these are not public monies that are coming out of the governor's budget or that the General Assembly is putting into the budget. That certainly changes the equation for me.
Or tuition.
I fully appreciate that alumni that give to the college often express particular uses that they want to put to the money. Most of them I would agree with. There's a handful that I wouldn't agree with, but it's their money. I also appreciate what the foundation does to support the institution and that this is viewed as an investment with return that might someday subsidize some of the programs that are being eliminated. I appreciate that as well. Look, just recently Kiplinger ranked College Park again among the top 10 public colleges for best value. That's attributable to the work of the administration, the faculty, the students, and the foundation. You guys are doing some good work. You make great decisions. Not all of them are the best, but certainly because of those factors, I'm supportive of this one here. So, you know, do the Treasury have anything?
I think this is a move that was long needed and was acknowledged by just about everybody who had to work with that building. I haven't seen the plans for the new building that the foundation's going to build, but I believe that it will be much more workable and a very good investment.
Anything on this item? We should take this. Oh, is it? How many items do you have? You only have one item. Okay.
And congratulations to the university on its recognition in Kiplinger's.
Very proud of that.
Joined by a few other members of the
campuses.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyone want to defer this for a couple of weeks?
No, only kidding. I'm happy to move forward and vote now. Okay, so the treasurer moves approval, seconded by the lieutenant governor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The comptroller. So that is approved.
Thank you.
Okay, let's move on to the Department of Information Technology.
It's a little warm up here. Good afternoon, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Elliot Schlanger, Department of Information Technology. I have one and only one item on the agenda this afternoon, and I'll be happy to answer any questions at this time.
Okay. Any of the members have any comments or questions on this item? Okay. I'm seeing none. Comptroller moves approval. Seconded by the Treasurer. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? None. Your agenda is approved. Congratulations. And the last agenda for today, Department of General Services.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Comptroller Al Collins, Secretary of Department of General Services. We have eight items on our agenda, and we're glad to answer any questions you have on any of these items.
I had a quick question. On item five and six.
Yes, sir.
you're requesting approval to declare surplus properties in Frederick, and apparently you're going to offer them for sale. What's curious is the description is that the units are in great disrepair and have been vacant for the last 7 years. What exactly is the reason why they sat vacant for 7 years and were allowed to deteriorate?
These are, thank you very much, Controller. These two items are related to the programs of the Department of Health and Human Services. These were former houses or group homes that they used. Because of the change in the program some years ago, these homes were no longer in use for programs, and they were allowed to sit just because there was no money to put into them. And there was no money at that particular time. There was no interest, and anyone wanted to sell them. We now have interest of prospective purchases, and that's why we're asking you to declare these surplus.
Okay. And do you have something in place that would allow us to intervene earlier with unneeded projects or unneeded properties so that we are not? I take it if we'd sold it 7 years ago, we would have done better as far as the, or perhaps we could have done better as far as the price. And you know what I'm driving
at. Of course.
Are we, do we have some way to monitor what is vacant and deteriorating, and you step in regardless of who the agency is?
We are working, and certainly the representatives of the HMS is here.
Mr. Kim is here? Deputy Secretary, great. I didn't see you back there. Why does he sit vacant for 7 years?
Good afternoon. As the Secretary Collins had mentioned, is that when these homes were shut down, whereby the provider did move to another area within the within Frederick, is that the homes then were then recommended to be surplused, under which case the Department of General Services goes out and seeks potential buyers, and it has taken quite a number of years to identify that buyer. There have been a couple of appraisal processes that have taken place within the last 6 years. With the most recent appraisal of the property, that is what triggered the interest of the buyer.
Because the price went down?
That would be correct, yes.
Funny thing.
The housing market in Frederick is I'm not a real estate expert, but it has been difficult. There's a property for sale that is adjacent to this property that has been on the market as well, which has provided the competition within the market.
Let me ask that with my real estate representative. Wendy, please introduce yourself.
Good morning. Wendy Napier, Chief of Land Acquisition and Disposal. I actually received some new information this morning. We've been working with these properties for so long. I learned that on 13 West 3rd Street, there were some boundary survey issues. We could not complete the disposal process without having survey work done. And survey work was done in 2007 and additional work done in 2009. So it really wasn't truly until 2009 that we had a correct legal description for the property and could proceed at that point. So we did proceed in order appraisals, and we've been fortunate enough to find folks that are willing to purchase the property now. On 127 East Patrick, in 2006, we were working with the then provider who was using the facility, trying to negotiate a contract, and that fell through. Then in 2008, the property was vacated, and we've been working, and we have actually ordered appraisals on that property three separate times, and each time we've been unsuccessful in finding a purchaser of the property. We got caught with the 2008 downturn, and we're just kind of working as the market was lowering. So we're at a point now where we have appraisals that have been approved by our office, and we've fortunately been able to find purchasers. So
what are those prices?
We will be bringing that item back at the next agenda. I apologize, I don't have that with me today, but We are working through the contracts now, but they were purchase prices that were in agreement with our recommended appraised values.
Okay, well, we'll take a look at that when they come. And, you know, my concern is that the price drops not just because of the market, but because the houses are not maintained.
And they have been broken into several times. So that's added to vandalism, added to their decline as well.
So I think a question
that's exactly my point.
The question that's raised, the larger question for me at least, is when the state vacates facilities, really any facility, whether it's used for residential or used for any other infrastructure support, does MDOT or DGS, depending on where the facility resides, do you do a kind of a cost-benefit analysis of, you know, what is it going to take to maintain it in a minimal state of repair for a period of time that we anticipate will take to dispose of the property? Or do we, when we make decisions either because of program or budget to walk away from a facility, we just walk away from it, like banks often do, right? Something goes into foreclosure and banks just walk away from it. They're not in the business of maintaining their properties. Is that true for us as well, or do we try to maintain our facilities until we dispose of them?
I can share that it's really on a per-agency basis. I'm working closely with the military department right now on disposing of several armories through the state, and military is being very proactive in that we're actually projecting when these installations will be closed and therefore surplus, and we're reaching out to local governments to explore options. The local governments have the right of first refusal on the armories. So with military, we've got a great system in place to make sure things aren't deteriorating. Not to slight other agencies, but with a lot of the other agencies, there are many factors that go into when a building or facility right. is disposed of. So we really need to explore with those agencies the criteria that you're suggesting. I do get calls at times on facilities that are vacant, and I call agencies to say, you know, this local government's inquired about this vacant facility. Are you ready to dispose of it? And I'm told at times the administration's not made that decision yet. So it's really on a per-agency basis, but it's definitely something I'm sure our agency would be happy to explore and work more closely so we don't have these problems in the future.
I think the Comptroller and Governor raised excellent points. I mean, has the city of Frederick not been concerned about these derelict buildings?
My office has not received any communication, I guess other than the neighboring property owners who've notified us when things have occurred. Since they've been under our purview, so to speak, for the disposal process,
so we have an absentee landlord that hasn't taken care of the building or disposed it.
Well, they not truly absentee, but you're right in the fact that no one's there on a day-to-day basis.
Right, on a day-to-day. The agencies try to do a minimum because you've got to take operating funds and you've got to figure out what your priorities are. So we do a minimum, usually around security, exterior items.
So who gets the money when this is sold?
I'm sorry?
Who gets the money when this is sold?
We're going to confirm with DHMH where the monies will be returned to. I know it depends sometimes on funds we need to purchase. And sometimes those funds are returned. We can share that when we come back with the item to dispose of the property. But typically,
I'd like to hear about that. Sometimes, some years ago, we tried to create a program with DDA that would benefit them and help them move people out of large facilities into the community, so that they actually got some financial benefit and the money could follow the individuals out. I don't know if there's anything like that beyond DDA. I don't know if it's still working with DDA. But I do know that the agencies have large number of unmet priorities and probably property transactions are not at the top. I don't blame them one bit. But they are to the state's bottom line, and there's got to be a way of dealing with it.
Can you I'm willing to hear. I think what would make sense, particularly for DGS, because it seems to me that at some point it's the department sends it to you for disposition.
That's correct.
If, and I got to assume you've got an inventory of those properties,
And if you can just give us some basic information of the members of the board about, you know, describe the, the property. It's, residence 37 West Street, Frederick. How long it's been vacant? How much money you've been put? How much, if any, money we've been putting into maintaining it? And many of them, I'm sure, will say zero. It is what it is.
Sure.
And what the maybe anticipated disposition date is, or some note field saying, given a
actually, the state requires that the properties go into the clearinghouse process, which is prescribed by the Department of Planning. At that point, the Department of Planning then advertises these projects either to local governments or the state agencies, and certainly the open market, at which point, if there are no takers, then it goes into the surplus process, which we bring here. But I'd be glad to take a look at what we have in the clearinghouse process and get you
that. And how much is waiting there that hasn't been moved to the clearinghouse process?
I don't have an answer for that.
Sitting on the
there
books.
There are properties sitting on agencies' books
that
I don't know about. Because
you don't have visibility on that?
No.
Well,
but we do. We know just. We do have a certain number of large projects, such as the number of the old state hospitals that closed.
Yeah, these little houses.
Yeah, and these little houses that were used that have not moved.
Yeah. Not to get personal, but near my house, we have a place that's basically abandoned, and the citizens have been just furious over this because when the house is allowed to deteriorate, the appraisals go down, so we get less money, but everybody's property value goes down. That turned out to be a situation that's been corrected, but you would have thought, talk about Tillman Islands Beach, people were, it's bad. And so I applaud the treasurer and the lieutenant governor, and I think if we are owning properties that are decrepit and deteriorating and look like they are about to go up in flames with a fire or something, we should take action. And
we owe it to the communities.
Yeah. We shouldn't burn them. No. Not at least the one near my house. Just
okay.
Keep
any other comments or questions on the DGS's agenda? Here are none. Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the Comptroller. All those favor say aye. Any opposed? None. Movement. Agenda's approved. Move for adjournment. Happy New Year. Oh, sure.